Rolling.
Hey, I'm Jonah, joined by
Brad.
How's it going, Brad?
Oh, it's going well. I'm very busy these days, which
yeah.
is why I never sit in on podcasts, except for this one.
Brad did sit in on this one, which I'm so glad that you did, actually.
It was pretty interesting.
Yeah. So today's guest on the podcast is Chris Barron from the Spin Doctors, who I met through our friend Seth Herzog at a show and was like, dude, you have to do my podcast, and basically just harassed him over email and Twitter for a few months and basically forced him into coming in.
Yeah. Worked.
It did work, yeah. Persistence usually pays off, I feel like, in these types of situations. But yeah, I thought it was like a really, this is a really cool conversation.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad I sat in on it because we had some things to talk about.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Spin Doctors, their success, kind of the aftermath, what it was like just kind of playing around the East Village when they were coming up. I mean, I didn't realize that they were such like a, you just see a band on MTV and you're just like, oh, this is a new band, but it seemed like they really gigged a lot.
Yeah, no, I used, it's funny because in the early 90s, when I first moved to Manhattan, I lived right down like the road from Wetlands. And that's kind of where they got their start, Wetlands, which is over by the Holland Tunnel. It was kind of a hippy dippy joint, although we later played there. And then,
see, yeah, I knew it as just like a hardcore club. I know, legendary,
that was later.
I never
it was
went
totally
there.
A hippie club in the beginning.
That's so like, interesting.
Like when those guys started, it was them and Blues Traveler every freaking other week there. And yeah, Wetlands. It was like a cool place to see bands. It was great for hardcore because it had low stage and it was just like, it was kind of a good setup. But that was totally later. It started off totally hippy dippy.
Interesting.
Yeah, man.
But yeah, so now Chris does a lot of solo stuff, and tomorrow, April 16th, this is being released the morning of the 15th, he's playing, if you're listening to this, he's playing at the Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 3, at 8:30, so go check him out. He plays a bunch of different stuff, and he's playing 2 days later, the 18th, at the Turning Point in Piermont, New York, at 6 p.m., and you can follow him on Twitter and Instagram at TheChrisBarron. 2 R's for rock and roll, as he said, which no one ever forgets, which is
and
true.
You could probably go buy one of his t-shirts, which are really well printed, I hear.
Oh, yes. oh, Brad. Yes. His t-shirts are great, I'm sure. I'm not sure if he uses Commonwealth Press.
I'm sure he does.
He probably does. Everyone does these days. but yeah, they were nice enough to sponsor a few episodes of Going Off Track. And if you go to commonwealthpress.com/podcast, you can get 6 free shirts with your order.
That's 6 free shirts.
That is 6 free high-quality shirts.
Or half a dozen.
Or half a dozen.
Whichever you would prefer.
So check out Commonwealth Press. Check out Chris Barron. He also mentioned that he's going to be releasing stuff kind of online, his solo stuff. So keep an eye out for that. And, yeah, enjoy this interview with Chris Barron of the Spin Doctors. Yeah. I was gonna make a pun, and then I just decided I would not. For once, I would not do it. So just listen to him. Okay.
It's going on.
Yeah, but Steven, I used to host a show for Fuse called Steven's Untitled Rock Show, and Steven and me started doing the podcast together. But he has twins now. But he actually lives in Princeton Junction.
That is such a weird place to live.
Yeah, he was in the East Village forever, and then when he had kids, moved out there. And
that's so funny. Princeton Junction is like, you know, it's like, well, it's probably more built up now and a little bit more like residential. But when I was a kid, it was like, you know, the train goes from New York to Princeton Junction, and then you take the dinky train, this little bitty train that goes 4 miles or something into Princeton and stops like right next to the university.
Okay.
So it's like an old time, you know, like that's like an old time train thing, junctions, you know?
Right, right.
Like it, you know, and this train, the dinky train, which is, I don't know if that's its formal name, but, you know, like it only went back and forth between Princeton and Princeton Junction. So Princeton Junction like used to be just sort of this little junction, a train station, and a few like houses. It was sort of like a little like island of civilization between two malls, you know, between like Quaker Bridge Mall and then next mall on the way, excuse me, on the next mall on the way to.
That was loud.
Anyway, how's he like it out there?
I think he is going a little crazy just because he's home with like twin girls who are like 3 years old every day. His wife still works a few, so she comes in the city. So he's a little, I think he likes it out there, but you know, I think it's,
you know, I, when my daughter was a baby, like I had her half of the time by myself.
Okay.
And like, I mean, I was like just dude with a baby, you know, like phone in the crook of my shoulder, you know, frying pan in my left hand, you know, baby in my right hand, like vacuuming with my foot, you know? And like all my friends were like, baby, what? You know, like they were all just dudes, you know, and like my parents, my mom was living in Australia, my dad was living in California, and I was just a, like a dude with a baby. And
no manual.
Yeah, totally. And no freaking manual. Like, and it was like, do you know the Yiddish word nachas?
No.
It's a great, great Yiddish word. I mean, it's like the feeling you get when, like, the grandparents get when they look at their, like, grandchildren's beaming faces on Christmas morning. You know, okay. It's like that, except that Jews don't have Christmas. But, like, it was sometimes you just, like, and especially, like, me, like, I'd never had any kind of, like, that kind of, like, experience of love before. You know, like, walking in the door and having your kid, like, just, like, fly shrieking into your arms going like daddy, you know, like no matter what you did, like I could give her like a rubber band and she'd be like, thank you, daddy, you know. But and then at the same time it was like brain numbingly boring at times. You're just like, you know, they want to play Barbies and like I don't know how to play Barbies. You know, it was just like me and her. So it was like, okay, Barbie's going to the moon. And there's these aliens on the moon. And they're like shooting at her. And she's like, daddy.
Yeah, you're still, you know, you can still fall back into a 10-year-old boy so quickly.
Yeah,
in that
scenario.
Yeah. I have a daughter. And,
yeah. But I got no 10-year-old girl inside of me. You know, let alone like a 2-year-old girl, you know, or a 3-year-old girl.
That's wild.
The bank is empty.
Today we're joined by Chris Barron from Spin Doctors. And
why did you look at me like inquiringly?
Well, because I actually looked online and it seemed like there was, do you have two last names or something? I felt like you were listed as different names, so I just wanted to make sure I didn't fuck it up.
Oh, no. Chris Barron. I mean, Chris Barron. That's a stage name.
Okay.
It's a stage name. I don't know if I should say my real name on
air. You don't have to say
air,
it, but
yeah, it's Chris Gross. It's a matter of public record.
Okay.
I'm Christopher Barron Gross, and Barron's my middle name and my mom's maiden name.
Okay.
But I mean, first of all, Gross, you know, that's a one word pitch for changing your name.
Probably responsible for you being a successful musician because you probably got teased in grade school, right?
Totally. My first memory, when I was a little kid, I lived in Rye, New York, and, my first memory, we lived on a cul-de-sac, and my first memory is all the big kids in the neighborhood riding their bicycles around. You know how cul-de-sacs have, like, that circle of bushes at the, you know, in the middle of the, you know, it's like a cul-de-sac, you know, at the street going down, and then it ends in a circle, and then there's, like, a circle of bushes. And the big kids were, like, they were riding their bikes around, pushing me into the bushes every time I tried to get out, singing, like, Chris is gross. That's my first memory.
Dude, it's a boy named Sue.
Totally. That song, that's so funny you should bring that up because my dad was really into country music and Johnny Cash, like I had so many like awakenings listening to Johnny Cash's like greatest hits. Like that song, A Boy Named Sue, you know, I guess for your listeners who aren't familiar with the song, it's a song about a boy named Sue and he hunts for his dad disappears when he's like a little kid and just gives him this name Sue and he hunts his dad down
to kill him
for giving him that name and they have this amazing bar fight and in the song he's like knock me down, I got back up and cut off a piece of my ear. It's like it's insane, you know, it's like it's crazy.
That's like my favorite Johnny Cash song.
And in the end of the song the dad's like, listen, I knew I couldn't be around and I gave you that name so that you'd learn how to fight and you'd learn how to be tough. And, and then they hug each other and like drink a beer together. Yeah. But yeah, that's so funny. That's really funny that you should mention that because like, I remember being like 7 years old, and my dad used to listen to that on cassette in the car all the time. And listening to Folsom Prison Blues, you know, like there's that one line in there where he's like, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, that line really, you know, like bothered me, but in a good way, you know, like couldn't get it out of my head. And I was like, Dad, did Johnny Cash kill a man? You know, and my dad was like, no, you know, he wrote the song. It's a story like that he's making up. It's a character, and the character in the song, you know, is this made up character who like killed a guy. And I was like, oh, but why did he shoot him just to watch him die? And my dad goes, because he's a really bad dude. And I was like just brain exploded. Like, you know, for me, that was like, oh, people write songs and they put crazy shit in them. Anything they want. Like, maybe I could do that.
That was a turning point.
It was a big, yeah, it was a big, like, big realization. I think, like, do you guys think, like, I think when you, like, are just sort of bound to do something in your life, like, you just stumble across these kinds of insights when you're really early. Like, I was just deeply impressed by songs and songs in particular. You know, I just remember, like, from there, just getting, I heard, I mean, years later, I heard an interview, with Steve Winwood, and it was on WPRB in Princeton, which is like the college station, and they were like, they had this like fledgling guy interviewing him, and it was when Roll With It was out. Was that that song? It was like,
yes,
you know, it was, that was a great tune, and but it was, you know, definitely like a kind of a crossover for him, and it had like kind of a poppy thing, and this, you could tell that this interviewer was like, had a chip on his shoulder. Like, he was like a little hipster guy,
right,
had a chip on his shoulder that he wasn't like playing Hammond organ, you know, on like in Electric Ladyland on a Jimi Hendrix session anymore, you know. And then he was like doing this like soul thing, and he was like, well, what genre of music do you like? And I'll never forget this. Winwood was like, I don't go by genre. I go song by song. You know? It's like some song. You know, I just like songs.
That's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, you know? It was like, I'm not really interested in genres. And then, so then I started thinking about genres and like, you know, what kind of, what bullshit they are in a way. You know, they're really like, because later on doing like interviews and stuff, people would ask me to classify my own music. And I'd be like, you know, that's your job, you know? Like, I don't know how to classify, or no, I probably would know how to classify it. Like, but I'm not interested in classifying, you know, like I always feel like from there, I sort of realized like, the genre from like a writer's standpoint is really an afterthought. You know, you have an idea for a song, and then you try to get to the heart of the song as a writer, you know, figure out what that song is really about. And then you solve the problems that proposition brings up, you know, and so that you have like a cohesive song that you know, maybe your idea sort of progresses and it morphs into something that wasn't exactly the original idea. But in solving those problems, you bring the idea to its logical conclusion and you end up with this cohesive thing at the end. And then you're like, oh, you know, I wrote a reggae song. You know what I mean? Like, the genre's like...
It's funny because I was in pretty much like a punk rock band.
And, yeah.
I had the country music test when I would write a song, is that after I'd had it pretty much laid out in a range, is I would pick up an acoustic guitar and try to play it as a country song. And
yeah.
If it worked, then I knew that it was a good song.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we worked with, oh, shoot. Man, I cannot remember anybody's fucking name today.
It's Planetary Alignment.
Last name is Wallace. He's a really great producer.
Andy Wallace?
He did Maroon 5's second record. Let's look him up on the old interweb. But he made us like the Spin Doctors did a record with him, and he'll be in my contacts on my phone.
Andy Wallace. That's
Matt Wallace.
Matt Wallace.
Okay. Matt Wallace.
They're both producers, I guess.
Yeah, Matt. He's a brilliant, brilliant producer, and he wouldn't let us. We were working in some.
Oh, he produced The Replacements. Don't Tell a Soul.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
That I recognize.
And he did I Went In All, But You Can't Have It.
Yeah.
Those guys?
Faith No More.
Faith No More, and you know he's a badass. Yeah, he's a real badass.
That's
and
sick.
He terrific, terrific producer, and he, I learned so much making that record actually from
which
him.
Record was that?
It's the Spin Doctors record, Nice Talking to Me.
Okay.
And he did such a great job on it. It's you know you're working with, I don't know, it's funny because sometimes you work with people and they confuse you and it's bad. And sometimes right. You work with people and they confuse you and it's great, you know? And that's like, Matt was like that. Like Matt, I'd be doing backing vocals and he kept telling me like, okay, sing this like you're a black guy, like on the corner, like singing in the street. And I'd be like, but that doesn't match the like tone. And he's like, just do me a favor. Just do me a favor. And he would like direct me until I was like a caricature, you know, like until it wasn't just like singing it like some, he would do it until it was like just this crazy, you know, I'd be singing like this and just doing some crazy, crazy ass thing. And like, I finally was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Cause then he'd be like, okay, sing it like falsetto. I'd be like, okay. And I had to stop him. Like, I couldn't get through the process. Like, cause it was just too weird and too confusing. And I was like, you know, I'm thinking like, we're just spending time and I got to fly home in 10 days and, you know, right. I'm in LA and like, what the hell is going on here? And he was like, what I'm trying to do is like if I get all these different characters in there, I feel like subconsciously the listener is gonna hear like all these different tones. So if there's an angry guy in there and like a happy guy and like a falsetto-y angelic guy in there and then like a you know, nasty low down dude in there, you know, like people are going. If I tuck them all in together in just the right way, people in like a bad mood will pick up on it. People in a good mood will pick up on it. And like when I listened back to then I was like, oh, cool. You know,
right.
Let's do this. And then we just started like devising all these fucked up, you know, crazy like dudes, you know, to be singing in the backing vocals. And when he got a really cool mix of it, it sounded fucking amazing, you know? And I'd never, to me, like I came in there being like, you know, this is 12 years ago or something like that. So, I mean, you know, to me, singing backing vocals was all about tightness, just going in there
right.
And like, and I was proud of my ability to like, you know, whether it's me, you know, doing a backing vocal on my own stuff or like coming in and doing a backing vocal on somebody else. I was like proud of my ability to come in and just like, I could just do that. I'd get my ear around like a backing around a lead vocal and I could just cover it like a cheap suit,
right.
You know what I mean? Like just lacquer it. So it just didn't sound like anything was happening except another note like was magically in there, you
right.
know? And wow, that sounded really egomaniacal, but you know what I mean?
That's
like a skill.
Job.
Yeah. It's my job. You know, like, yeah, exactly. Just wanted to, that to me was, it was all about just being super duper, you know, tight. And,
right.
and then when, you know, you come across somebody else who's just like, well, what if it's not tight? What if it's weird?
Right.
In my like, and it's weird for this reason, you know?
It's interesting because one of the biggest, I mean, it's funny the way he described the reason for you to do that, which is cool. I think also from like a more technical point of view, one of the things that I've found is when you've got, especially if you have bands where you don't have a lot of people that sing, maybe one or two.
Yeah.
When you do background vocals, layering the same vocal over and over again, you get into really, no matter how good it is, you get into these problems where there's just not enough like richness to it. There's not enough thickness, and even to the point where certain frequencies just really get like one of the tricks that you'll see engineers do, I'm sure you've seen, is they'll swap out the mics every time you do another take.
Yeah.
And like the idea is just to try to make it sound a little different.
See, that's funny because I was naturally doing this thing that the Fowler brothers, Bernard Fowler, who sings backing vocals for the Rolling Stones.
Right.
We had them come in and do backing vocals. And when they would layer their vocals, they would like triple and quadruple them. And so what they would do is they would do one that was like straight up the middle. Then they'd do like a slightly breathy one. Right. And they'd do like a super breathy one. So when I like, you know, when I'm doing, I always like, you. That's the thing is there's definitely like, there's an art to it. And you gotta like, you have to, you know, I was already kind of doing what Matt was saying, but he was taking it, because I was doing it like with the tone.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because
you understood
you're right.
The concept that you didn't.
It's gotta be.
He gave you some technique.
Yeah, you do one that's like a veneer, you know, that's like super duper tight, super duper on it. They're all super duper tight and super duper on it. But like you do some, a breathy one, a slightly breathy one, and you know, you have to switch up the tone depending on the recording.
Right.
You know what I mean? But he was like, he wanted me to be different people.
Right, right, right.
You know what I mean?
It's awesome. I mean, it's a great idea.
Like, yeah.
It makes perfect sense because, I mean, also because the first thing you've got to do as a producer is get what you want out of the artist, no matter how. Like,
yeah.
That might not even have been his intention. He may not even, he may have been totally bullshitting you. Like, I don't care. I don't want people to hear all these different emotions. I want them to hear one emotion, but I want them to have this thick layer of, like, dude singing it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? But that's the best way for him to get it out of you was to, like, I mean, or maybe he really did. Maybe he was being straight up. But I think it's just, like, the fact that he knew how to, that's a sign of a great producer.
Yeah, it is a sign of a great
producer.
That
he knew the best way to get the performance that he wanted from you was to explain this to you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, like, you know, I think that was straight up like his thing, because he wasn't explaining it to me at all. And I'm the kind of guy where like if I know what the concept is and I like it, I'll jump out the window for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so after that, once I realized, oh, there's a method to this guy's madness, then I would just do anything he asked me to, because I was like, this comes out really cool when I just do his weird shit, you know?
Dude, that's a great. I mean, that's a really good technique, though. I wish.
Yeah, you should try it. It's really funny. It comes out really cool.
Yeah.
It comes out really cool. But actually, I brought up Matt because of your country uh-huh. punk rock country test. And he wouldn't let us like we were rehearsing in, you know, this nice rehearsal studio in LA. So, in these, you know, for your listeners who've never been to a nice rehearsal studio in LA, like these, you got this big room with like these nice amplifiers and actually a PA, like a public address system, like you'd have at a show, pointing back at the band. So, you know, the singer's got a mic, drummer's got a drum
like
set, everybody's got, SIR, you know, everybody's got like, you know, it's the same kind of rig that you would have pretty much on stage, but you're just in this room playing together. And then usually like there's like a couch and some chairs and stuff like that, like a setup, you know, over on the side of the room. And he made us like sit on the couch and the chairs and made a drummer like just pat his knees, like playing no drum set, and made the bass player had like another little tiny amp, and he made our guitar player just play acoustic, you know, and I just sang with no microphone, and he wouldn't let us get onto the rigs, onto the amplifiers until like we could just play till we had it like till it the arrangement sounded good just on acoustic, which I immediately was like, this is you know, this is the shit. Like, duh, this is great. But it drove our guitar player crazy, you know?
Something's going to, though.
Yeah, well, you know, that's guitar players. You know what you throw a drowning guitar player?
What?
His amplifier.
You've got two guitar players looking at you.
I'm a guitar player, too. And I'm a lead singer.
Yeah.
I'm the worst of both worlds. Yeah, you know how many lead singers? You know how many lead singers it takes to screw in a light bulb?
No.
One, as long as the world continues to revolve around it. How do you know?
I must have known that one.
How do you know a lead singer is at your door?
How?
He knocks out of time. He doesn't have the key. And he doesn't know when to come in.
How many producers does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know.
I don't know. What do you think?
All right, one more guitar player joke. This guitar player goes to hell, right? And it's like this awesome club, you know, but it's kind of a shithole, but it's funky and it's cool. It's, it sounds really good in there. And it's full of people who are like rocking out. There's a band on stage and they're fucking killing it, right? This demon comes out of the shadows with a 59, a Les Paul 59, like flame top guitar, hands it to the guitar player. The guitar player is like astonished, you know, $50,000 guitar. Like takes it, puts it on, you know. The demon like gestures to the stage, you know, and the guitar player gets on stage, plugs into this like beautiful 70s Marshall rig, turns it on. It's like, it sounds unbelievable. Leans over into the eaves of the stage, you know, to the demon who's like still standing there with his arms folded. He says, are you sure this is hell? I mean, you know, this amazing guitar, great crowd, great club, great band, you know. The demon kind of shrugs, you know, this non-committal gesture. And the guitar player goes, when do I get a solo? And the demon goes, never.
That's amazing. What was sort of the process for like the earlier stuff, like Pocket Full of Kryptonite and that stuff? Did you have a lot of direction from the outside, or was that kind of more just you guys?
That was very much us, you know. When we started this band out, I was like a, you know, a 19-year-old kid with a bunch of tunes in a one of those black and white composition notebooks, like writing in fucking fountain pen, you know, and super analog because digital didn't exist yet. And, you know, I met the guys. I was playing like solo acoustic between the sets of the Blues Traveler. I went to high school with the Blues Traveler. So they moved to New York City a year before I did. And I followed them a year later and moved in with those guys. And they were like, you're not in the band, but you can play in between our sets. We were playing this place called the Nightingale Bar. And so I met Eric Shankman, the guitar player, and he had a gig up at Columbia, a frat party. So we kind of put a band together. We got Aaron Comas. We had a different bass player to begin with. And he and I just started kind of working together. And we were this kind of, you know, like part of this kind of, you know, it's funny because, you know, I don't think people think of us this way because we achieved like, you know, this like kind of pop status, you know, but we were this underground, like New York City improvisation, you know, jamming kind of band, coming along with the Blues Traveler. And we, you know, we were kind of pals with like Fish, and, you know, we hit the road after the band had been together for 6 months or a year, and we just toured our freaking brains out and got signed. So by the time we went into the studio, these songs, you know, Little Miss Can't Be Wrong, Two Princes, 40 or 50, Refrigerator Car, all that Pocket Full of Kryptonite stuff, it was pretty polished because we'd been playing it live for a year or two. So we had a guy named Frank Aversa started out produced kind of the first half of the record, and Peter Denenberg produced the second half, kind of took over at one point and finished out the record. And, you know, they were kind of gently guiding us, but they were smart enough to kind of like let us, you know, tighten things up when it needed to, but kind of let us go because we all really, I think, had an instinct, you know? And so meanwhile, you know, Frankie LaRocca, who passed away several years ago, was our A&R guy. And for your listeners who don't know what an A&R guy is, it's like an extinct form of record executive. It used to mean artist and repertoire. So it was the liaison between the label and the band. And so he worked at the label, but his job was to help us to make the best record that we could, and to make sure that the, you know, the label was getting their money's worth, and that we weren't just in the studio you know, snorting cocaine or some stupid, right. crazy crap like that. So, which we weren't. And so, yeah, they kind of, you know, we were like almost as much a gang as we were a band. Like the president of the record label would walk in and be like, "Oh, gentlemen," he was English. "Oh, don't you think that you should maybe pick up the tempo a little bit?" And we would laugh him out of the studio. And I look back now and I was like, man, we had balls, you know, like we didn't give a shit what anybody thought. And we saw ourselves as the sole arbiters of what was going down in that studio, note by note. And I think that all of the best projects I've ever been a part of, it was very clear who had a say creatively and who did not. You know, the best records I've ever made, it was like, okay, you know, the band and this guy, the producer, the band and this guy and this guy, you know, and anybody else, like, you'd listen to people's input, but, like, you kind of look around at each other and be like, no, they don't know what the fuck we're doing here. And if they came in and gave some kind of input, you'd be like... You know, you didn't have to laugh them out of the room or be rude the way we were when we were like 20, you know.
Right.
But you know, there'd be this like look that would go around the room and just be like, that dude's out, you know, like whatever. That's bullshit. Because, you know, I mean, the more people you... It's funny because there's input and there's input, you know, and When I did a short stint at SUNY Purchase, I was, you know, just decided it was time to like give back a little bit. So I was teaching some songwriting there. I just did it for a year or two, and it was really interesting and informative. And I just didn't have the time to like give it, you know, I kept being like, oh, I'm going on tour, or I'll make up all these classes later. And then being like, oh crap, when am I going to make these classes up? And I was kind of screwing the students a little bit, you know, just by not having enough time. But like, they were all kind of really hungry for critiques, because that's the way they were being taught, was, you know, like bringing songs in and having them critiqued. And I was like, nobody ever critiqued my shit. I never wanted anybody to critique my shit. You know, what I always did was like, I still do this. It was like, I'd write a tune and all my buddies were like songwriters too growing up. You know, all my best friends were writing songs. So we would write songs. You know, you'd write a song and you'd be like, hey, I wrote a song. You want to hear it? And we'd be like, yeah, because that was what we were all about, you know? And you'd play the song and you'd be playing the tune and you'd just be feeling the vibe in the room. You know what I mean?
Right.
Just, you'd be watching them. And I'd be critiquing their reaction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you could just tell, you know, you could tell, you play the song and you're like, nobody says anything. You don't even have to look at anybody. You know what I mean? But like, you can feel like a line goes over really well. I'll never forget this. Like, you know, I wrote this tune. I never put it out. But it's called, When You're Done. It's a song about a guy who's like talking to you know, a girl that he loves. And he's like, yeah, when you're done, like, with that other guy, remember I am the one. When you're done, remember I am the one. And so the last verse, I'm writing it, and I came up with this really clunky-ass line. It's like the last verse starts out like, when you're done fooling around with that mook, come see about your incorrigible kook. And it like, it didn't, it was so wonky, it didn't even fit in. So right. I had to, after I go incorrigible kook, I just had to play like a bar of like, of G, you know, like I was rang, gang, gang, gang. Remember December is cold and I'm as warm as the sun. When you're done, remember I am the one. And like, I was like, oh, that's stupid, but I'll just fix it later, you know? Right. So the next day, like, you know, a couple of my buddies come over, you know, Billy and Ben come over and we're having a cup of coffee. I'm like looking at my table, coffee table, and there's like that song sitting on the coffee table in a notebook. And I go, oh, hey, you guys want to hear this song? Like, yeah, sure, man. So I play it for them And I get to that line and I'm like starting the third verse and I think to myself, oh shit, I never rewrote this line. Oh, whatever, you know, I'll just play it. So I sing the incorrigible kook line and the two of them start laughing their asses off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the fact that it was all wonky and weird and I had to play that that bar of G, you know, like for nothing.
The extra bar.
It left room for the laughter, you know? And I was playing that tune around like for a little while and like that was the best line in the tune. That like made the tune, you know? But if I had asked somebody to critique that song, you know what I mean? Yeah. Even in my own like mental critique as I was writing it, that would have been the first line people would have gone to. They'd have been like, incorrigible kook. I mean, what are you doing there? I think you should rewrite that line. If I'd had somebody critique it, they would have taken that line out. But the thing is that when people critique your stuff, usually they go right to the coolest fucking thing, the little weird flaw in the diamond that makes the surprising colors pop out. And that's the first thing they want to chop out of it because the first time you hear it through, you know, you that's the thing that kind of, that's the bump.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, if you hadn't put that extra bar in, it probably would have just been clunk, but you made it clunkety clunk. You know what I mean?
You
exaggerated the clunkiness. So then it became a hook or whatever.
But that's what I was talking about before, you know, is like you, you know, a song, you have an idea for a song, you have this proposition, you know? And then the next thing you have to do is bring that proposition to some kind of a conclusion. You have to find out, like, what is this proposition about? What am I really, like, what is the question behind my question? And then usually what that turns out to be is, like, a bunch of smaller questions. And you have to answer all those questions as you're going along. So, you know, like, there I am, like, answering all these questions, you know, and I'm like, okay, how am I going to bring this idea home? You know, when you're done fooling around with that mook, you know, like, come see about your incorrigible kook, and it doesn't fit in. So part of that answer is, like, I got to leave, like, four bars for nothing just to, like, fit that weird line in. And, you know, and then you just let it sit. And you know, once that all like simmered for a while, that was the, you know, like raw garlic is going to blow your face off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you just kind of turn the heat down low and you just let it sit in the pan for a while, that's the flavor behind the flavor that makes everything taste so good.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it takes a long time to learn all this stuff.
It's you're learning how to make mistakes. You know, it's like, you probably, when you were 20, you know, you would be horrified by like thinking that you had something technically flawed. So that's why you have the gang mentality that you're talking about, because that's how you, that is what you use in place of confidence, which, you know, you later grow confidence, you know, and like,
see, but you're a guitar player. I'm a lead singer. So I was like, you know, when I was like seven, my like catch line as a little 7 year old was, you know, I'd like say something funny and make all the grown ups laugh, or cute or something like that, make all the grown ups laugh. And I would hold my hands up in like this, you know, gesture of self deprecation to go, no applause, please. Just throw money. 7 years old. Like, you know, lead singers, they ought to put us all in like in a van. And just close the garage door, turn it on, and just...
Oh, that would be rough.
Oh, rock and roll would be so much better without lead singers.
I mean, what was it sort of like during... Because it's like during this sort of maybe like the 90s, that era when like you guys were selling so many millions of records and you were sort of a lead singer. I mean, were you just like on private jets all the time? Because that's such like kind of like a mythical thing now. Like I feel that kind of stuff doesn't exist anymore.
We were so lucky to live through that like fat time, you know? I mean, it was like just sushi every day in the studio and like,
What label were you signed to?
We were on Epic, which was the, when we signed, it was CBS, but then a month later it became Sony.
Right.
So yeah, we were on Epic and, you know, let me think of some like really decadent stuff. We went to Gotham one night with, the label president, This guy, Richard Griffiths, lovely, lovely dude. We had this just unbelievable dinner. And then we ordered for dessert. I ordered a bottle of Chateau de Chem, which is like this dessert wine. And it was like, you know, $250 or something like that. And I was like, oh, let's get this. Look, they have a de Chem, you know? And Richard was like, oh, $250. That's quite cheap for that. Let's get a bottle. They bring it out and it's a half bottle. It's like a demi. It's a little demi bottle. And so we all have like a little taste of it, and it's like, you know, it's so delicious. And it's like fucking fairies dancing on your tongue, you know? It was so good. And I was like, let's get another one. And we just got another one, you know? It was like just crazy. Crazy,
yeah, I don't think labels
like that
have that budget.
No, man. It's a different world now.
Yeah, it's just straight up, you know, crazy expense account kind of stuff. But I have to be, it was so much fun. And at the same time, it's ironic because, like, as a band, we just were not getting along very well.
Even in the beginning?
No, in the beginning, like, the first year or two, we got along great. But we were just on the road nonstop.
Right.
Super burnt out. I look back now and I realize we all, you know, really care about each other, but we just didn't have like the emotional tools to communicate properly, you know? So I wish that we had been able to kind of, communicate a little better and like there were moments that I think we could have enjoyed a lot more. We sold out this huge shed in Milwaukee. It was like 44,000 people. And we go backstage afterwards, and it should have been like, I mean, it should have been just this huge milestone. My memory is like being backstage, like, you know, yelling at each other, and our guitar player throwing a chair, and like, you know, it's just like this crazy, you know, crazy stuff. And you know, it should have been more fun. But you know, that's the thing about being inexperienced, you know, is that you have this propensity to like squander the greatest moments of your life.
Focus on immediate things too much, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, similar story. I remember when we got signed to Warner Brothers, my band, my little band that had been fighting to, you know, like, fighting the world for so long, you know, to like get to that magical place where you get a record deal, and we got this great record deal. And like, I remember the lead singer literally like said, you know, guys, we need to, after rehearsal today, we got to go out and like get a nice dinner and like celebrate. We just got signed. Like, we were literally so focused on the next steps. Okay, now we have to pick a producer. What are we going to do with the, like, we were so caught up in the details that we didn't realize that we had just passed what we'd all been working for since we were 12 years old.
Yeah.
And we were about to just let it blow by without even acknowledging it.
Yeah, yeah.
And our, like, that's exactly what you're talking about.
Our guitar player, when we were playing, on Bleecker Street at this club called the Mondo Perso, and it was, you know, we were the shit hot club band in New York, you know, we were packing the snot out of places every single night. Cause back then, like, there wasn't like any internet, like people like left their houses and hung out together in bars, seeing bands every night, you know, and we were playing every night. We called it the Manhattan Tour. We were playing, you know.
Were you playing? I mean, you played Wetlands like once a week, right?
Yeah, we played Wetlands. We played the Mondo Cani, the Mondo Perso. Both of those clubs were owned by the same owner. We played Continental Divide, which is now the Continental, or maybe it's Coney Island something. I don't know.
It's Continental. They don't have bands anymore.
They don't have bands anymore. We used to play. We played there every Saturday night. That was our first like kind of that was the first club that was like, yeah, you're our Saturday night band. You know what I mean?
Trigger. And,
pardon me?
Trigger, the owner. Remember him? The guy who always
Yeah, totally, totally. who used to book it, though? We used to deal. I do remember Trigger. Man, I haven't thought about him in a long time.
Who was the guy that booked it? Was that old dude with glasses?
He was the guy that we worked with was an Australian guy.
Oh.
Man, he'd be so pissed off if he knew I couldn't remember his name. That's too many bong hits back in the hippie days. But like, I mean, here's a great, you know, story about what we're talking about. I mean, in New York back then, the clubs that really treated you fairly and paid the bands well were the Mondo Cani and the Mondo Paraiso. And they were booked by this guy whose name, believe it or not, was Adolf. And this sweet, lovely, like South African guy who's gayer than confetti back then, which, you know, wasn't like dudes being like openly flamboyantly gay was right. Like, you know, he was a brave dude and he used to wear like lederhosen and combat boots and just like frolic, you know, the cat was frolicking. And he, you know, really like he went out on a limb for us and the Blues Traveler, like these bands, like we were not, those were blues bars and we were not really like dyed in the wool blues right. bands, but we played the blues all night.
Right.
But like, you know, he had to fight for us with the owners of the bar and then we sold a lot of alcohol. So then they didn't care, you know, we made the bar money. So but he had to fight to get us in there. And if we were short on the phone bill, you know, he would like pay our phone bill. He paid our phone bills. He like paid our, you know, rent like on numerous occasions, Whoa. Like got us like past the first of the month, ticket out of our pay. But the thing was, you know, they paid $250 on a weeknight and $500 on a weekend. So if you could break into the weekends there, you were like, you know, you were doing really well. You could make a living in the city right. If you became one of the Mondo bands. So we played our first Friday night at Mondo Cane. We get paid $500. It's $100 a guy. We give $100 to Jason Richardson, our like, you know, manager. And I walk out of this bar. I got $100 in my pocket. I walk down to Bleecker Street to the Triumph Diner. It's a freaking Subway now, you know. Not a Subway stop, like a Subway sandwich,
right.
You know, and it was this great, you know, old time, you know, Greek style diner. And I walk in there and I look at the menu and I'm so used to ordering like a, you know, an egg sandwich or like the cheapest thing on the menu, you know, and I suddenly realized I got $100 in my pocket and I ordered a T-bone steak and a double thick milkshake. And, you know, all these sides. And then I got a side of coleslaw. Just because I could afford it. You know what I mean?
I didn't
even eat a bite of it, man. I just threw it on the ground. And, you know, later on, like, I'm not, like, a rich dude now. You know what I mean? I get some nice checks from BMI and everything like that. But you'd be surprised at, you know, like, two dot-com crashes and, you know, a bit of, you know, custody battle and a bit of like life going by and, you know, but I'm comfortable, you know, I'm not like, you know, riding around in yachts and taking private planes everywhere and stuff like that. But like, you know, we renegotiated our contract with Sony later on and got $1 million advance, which you'd be surprised at how much like the lawyers and the managers and everybody, it's like $1 million, it was amazing. And then you split it four ways. It was amazing how little was left. But I mean, you know, like, I mean, I saw $1 million check that came into like my band, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I never again felt as rich as I felt.
Right.
Like cutting into that T-bone steak.
Because once you, it's those early days, man. And you can celebrate these tiny little moments. Like, just even your first, not even getting paid, but the first Friday night you get to play in fucking New York. It's like so immense. Mm-hmm. And you'll remember that. And then, And as
it was huge.
As it gets serious and I always felt like it was this battle that we were fighting together, you know, as a band. We were like us against the world. We got to prove ourselves. And then you prove yourself and you get there and suddenly it's like a job. and all these amazing moments that you look forward to before you do, they can go right by.
Yeah,
that $1 million check, like yeah, you probably were like stressing out over it.
No, you have to like you have to you gotta like, because what happens is, it's like you're on this merry-go-round, you know, and deep inside we're all children. And we're helpless children, you know, and we're sitting on that like crazily painted horse that we're a little frightened of. And like, there's your mom and dad, you know, and like the gate that you walked in and the familiar faces of the people, you know, and then that crazily painted horse like carries you around to the other side where you can't see any of that anymore. And there's the brass ring, you know. And you're just reaching for it, and maybe you fall off the horse, maybe you get it, you know, but that brass ring then is on your finger and it's all you can see for a while.
Right.
You know? But the trick is to take the merry-go-round all the way back around, right, until you can see like mom and dad's face again, until you can see
the
place
ring
you walked in. Yeah, and but like, you know, the brass ring. And then you forget about the brass ring, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
And you're back to where you were like a child again, back to where you're like, you know, a little frightened, but it's fun. And you know, that's like, to me, I think the greatest achievement of like this portion of my life is that I'm finger painting again. You know, like I write a song and I don't care who's going to hear it. I don't care. Like, you know, I just like, I want to like it. I want to like, I write the way I wrote when I was a kid. You know, I sat down to write Two Princes. I was 19 years old, sitting on the edge of my bed. You know, I didn't know anything about like what I knew some stuff about writing songs, but I didn't know what it took to write like a hit song. I had no plan for that song. All I wanted to do was write a tune that like would make girls like me. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Of course.
And I wrote the first two lines of that song. So, you know, 1, 2, princes kneel before you. Princes who adore you. And it's just like that other tune I was telling you about before. I wrote those two down and looked at the top of the page. I had two lines on the paper and I was like, that's stupid. That's dumb. Where the hell is that going? And then, you know, one thing I learned to do really early on is, you know, when you're writing, you got a creative voice and you have an editing voice, and you have to find the volume knob on those voices. And when in the initial phases of like making something, you got to turn the editor voice knob all the way down and you got to turn the creative voice all the way up. So, you know, I just was like, you know, I was like, shut up, editor voice, you know, I'm turning you off. And was just like, turn back to the little yellow legal pad. And I was like, let's just see where this is going. Half an hour later, I had like the tune that is the reason why you guys like give a shit about talking to me right now. You know what I mean? I mean, I, you know, that's been like whether, you know, and I like that song, you know, somebody put something on like, an Instagram photo that I posted, like, you know, somebody posted a photo of me at a gig, and I'm wearing a tie, a Spin Doctors gig, and I'm leaning like way out over the edge of the stage, and they must have been like in the front row, and they held up their thing and they got a close up picture of me, and like some guy's like, you know, oh, I guess he's not a bike messenger anymore. The blah blah sellout, you know.
What?
And I was like, you know, like wow, you know, I mean, I think it's really funny because you know, almost everybody would sell out if they could. I don't know how to sell out. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't like, you know, and when that song, like, you know, we were on the road for 2 years behind that album before anything happened.
Sell out if you're nowhere at all and you have a hit.
Yeah,
it's
you
like,
know.
You can sell out if you already are kind of there in the business and you decide to, like,
no,
bring on some professional songwriters.
No, Sony, stop promoting my band. I don't want it to be successful. I don't want to make a living playing music. I mean, it's really, really funny. And I mean, you know, if you listen to the rest of that record, you know, that's a weird record. There's some, like, you know, there's some weird songs on that record. 40 or 50, Refrigerator Car. There's some dark ass shit. It's, you know, people, for people who are just like tuning in, my name is Chris Barron. I'm 47 years old. I'm the lead singer of this band, Spin Doctors. We're the guys who had that song, Two Princes. It's like, it's the one that's got the biddy biddy crap in it. You know, it was really big in the 90s. It was the most played song in the world on the radio in 1994, you know, and it's the thing that I'm known. It's the thing that I'm known for now. And, but you know, if you think that I'm like some goofball Muppet in a goofy Guatemalan hat, one, you're right. But two, you know, I challenge you to let go and check out the rest of that record, because, like, I think you'll find, like, that there's some really weird, you know, dark shit on there. And it was just, I always found it really funny because, you know, we came up at the same time as, like, Pearl Jam and Nirvana. And I love Nirvana. I love Soundgarden. I think they're really great bands. And at the same time, you know, I think there was a lot of bands out there that had a really nihilistic outlook. And I always felt that, you know, the purpose of, like, you know, a creative endeavor is to, like, put these ideas out there. And I believe that if your ideas don't offer, if your philosophy, any philosophy, if a philosophy, whether it's your philosophy or some other philosophy, that doesn't offer you some kind of solace in this world, then it's a pretty fucking useless philosophy. You know, like, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that the world is completely fucked and that it's driven by greed and that we're all subject to forces outside of our control, and that, you know, tragedy strikes good people. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot to figure out that the world is deeply, profoundly and tragically unfair. Okay, you figured that out? Okay, you're some kind of fucking genius. What's hard is, like, figuring out, like, why to go on? Why to live another day in this horrendous world where all these terrible things are happening? That's what's hard, is reconciling it. So, you know, I always said, like, you know, we were like the alternative to alternative, you know? Because, I mean, I'm not trying to put those other bands down, and I'm not trying to, like, find fault, you know, with their philosophy or anything like that. I'm just saying that for me, I always felt like, you know, it was important to, you know, face certain. But if you even like our tunes, like Two Princes, if you look at Two Princes, like, that's happy music with sad lyrics.
Right.
You know, if you put that song in a minor key, it would be kind of like, wow, okay, this guy is like, there's another dude that's got this, that's going to get this girl that this dude is in love with, you know?
But you could dance to it.
But you could dance to it, man.
That's the key. I remember when you guys were like, when all three of those bands you mentioned were really happening, and you guys got the girls because...
Yeah, girls liked our band.
You could dance to it.
They still do.
But I think there's also, like, a misconception that, like, you have to be this sort of tortured artist, and, like, that makes your art maybe more legitimate or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny.
He was tortured by his last name. I'm trying to explain that at the top of this podcast.
But the thing I think is, like, we're all sort of tortured, you know? Like, who's not tortured? I mean, I think that there's, like, you can be tortured without being tortured, sort of. You know what I mean? There's plenty of pain in this world to draw from. I think the myth is that you need to be tortured and subsequently crippled. You know what I mean? Because I think you do need to, like, tap into these negative emotions. That's the great thing that we have as artists, you know, the great consolation of any creative person is that you take, you know, all the shit of your life, and it's, you know, it becomes like the you know, that shit becomes like the fertilizer for your creations, you know? And, you know, I got all these great tunes from all of my, like, breakups. All the times I broke, my heart got broken in this life, I came out of it with a song, which is more than, you know, a lot of people can say for the heartbreaks that they suffer in this life. And I feel bad for people who don't have something to, like, you know, something to sublimate all the heartbreak of this life into, you know?
Yeah, to be able to actually get something out of that heartbreak. That's what you know, as an artist, you can do. And yeah,
it's the greatest.
It goes to waste if you're not an artist, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know what people do.
But then there's also, I think what, you know, Jonah was kind of alluding to is, like, what happens when you're happy? Can you still make good art?
Yeah, I think
the age-old question.
I think so. I think, you know, there's because there's not just, like, sadness to write about. There's irony, you know, and there's satire, and there's, you know, observations about other people. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I think I get some of the best stuff out of times when I'm, like, really angry and really sad. And I don't always write an angry or sad song, you know, but a lot of times that brings up stuff that, you know, that comes out to be, like, really good songs. But I'm working on a record right now. And, you know, like, you know, something that I really admire is Tom Waits, you know, who I don't think he's, like, you know, in that seedy, you know, monkey, jacked up, topsy-turvy, cracked, ramshackle world that he's, like, writing from. He doesn't, it's sort of, you know, the mud gets on his coat, but it doesn't get on his skin. You know what I mean? It's like,
I know what you're talking about. It's, you know, most people get their success because they're driven by something, you know, like you're saying, you just wanted to get laid when you're 19, you know, like, and that's almost 90% of the bands in the world. That was the motivating force.
I wasn't even, like, that far. I just wanted girls to, like, even like me.
Yeah, you just want to fucking...
I would have settled for being considered as a human being.
Yeah, and then you know, the successful artists that have long... They figure out how to keep something driving them, you know? I mean, and you talked about Kurt Cobain. In his case, there was something driving him that was dark, obviously.
Mm.
You know, hopefully... You know, you can find something to drive you that's not necessarily dark. I think Tom Waits is, like, he's like a journalist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think he loves these characters that he writes about, but they're not him.
Yeah.
You know, like, he pretends maybe that they are, but I think that's why he can continue to, like, literally have a constant sort of quality to his work, because he's, like, he never was that person in his song, I don't think. I think he's just, like, he's a great observer and an amazing journalist.
Yeah. I totally
he's
agree.
He's a lucky motherfucker for that reason.
Like, well, he's a poet. You know, he's a poet. And, like, not all poetry, you know, like, just, you know, when I'm writing a song, like, I'm going after these little, like, small objectives, you know, going line by line, looking for, like, you know, a double entendre or, you know, to I have all these little devices, you know, like one of the things I really like to do, I call it the primrose path, you know, the expression to lead someone down the primrose path means to sort of, you know, make them think that you're leading them towards something good, but then you're going to rip them off, you know, and or the outcome is not what they expected. And I love to, like, you know, language is full of these built-in expectations. You know, if I say a stitch in time, you know what's coming next. You know I'm going to say, like, saves nine, you know, but leading people down these linguistic paths and then turning it around at the end is one of the... So I'm just looking for, like, beautiful combinations of words, you know, and surprising combinations of words and trying to sort of, like, crack this language apart and look at the pieces shining in in the light of the window, you know, that I'm standing next to. And you don't have to be tortured to do that, you know? You can just be like a kook, you know? I always wondered why people, when I was young, you know, before I knew as much as I do now, I used to wonder why anybody would paint like a still life, you know? Why would somebody paint like a bowl of fruit, you know? And when I started working with Eric Shankman from the Spin Doctors, he had a great, big, huge, like, you know, 7 by 7 foot poster of this Cezanne painting of it's a still life. It's like a bowl of oranges.
Right.
And I used to look at it and be like, why did he paint a bowl of oranges, you know?
How boring.
And one day I was just sitting there and I realized, like, because it was a beautiful painting.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit me that all around us all the time, there's this moment that we're either like aware of or not, you know, but right now there are waves crashing against a beautiful cliff in Ireland. And if you were standing there with the wind in your face, you know, squinting against like the spray of the sea, you'd be mind blown, right? You know? And the sun is rising on, double suns are rising on the moons of other planets right now, right? You know? And someone is enthralled listening to like a piece of music they've never heard before right now. Right in this moment, right now, you know, somewhere somebody is like stroking their cat in the papery beam of sunlight that's coming through their gigantic window pane on a wood floor or the Persian carpet, you know, right now in this moment. And somewhere there's a bowl of fruit sitting on a table, you know, that someone is realizing is in another one of those kinds of fragile, beautiful moments. And it's always happening right now. And that's the thing. That's the thing. It's easy to find that immediacy in a violent moment. It's easy to find that immediacy when like evil Knievel is like riding a motorcycle up a ramp about to like, you know, cross 3 London buses. You know, it's easy to jump out of a plane and feel that, you know, but to be able to kind of sit in a room and forget that, you know, you have to go to the dentist next Thursday and forget that, like, you know, or remember that, but still realize that this beautiful calliope is unfolding all around you. That's the whole point of this whole thing. So you don't have to be tortured. It's easy to see that from a tortured place, because as soon as like someone like stabs you in the leg and you're bleeding, you're like, oh my God, you know, I'm going to die. You know, why was I so mean to my girlfriend when I walked out the door? You know what I mean? I think that's why people feel like they got to be tortured. But the truth is, like, you know, you can just look at a bowl of fruit. If you look at it with your head tilted and your eyes squinted and a paintbrush in your hand on the right day with the right light, it's right there all around you all the time.
Wow. I feel like I've got a pocket full of kryptonite right now.
I couldn't help it. You had to do it, dude.
Yeah. At least it's at the end of it.
What does that feel like anyway?
It's, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, to be totally honest. But, yeah, thank you so much to Chris for coming by. Please go see him tomorrow night at the Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 3. It's going to be awesome. Yeah, check out, after this interview, I watched, like, Spin Doctors' set from, like, Woodstock 94. There's so much stuff online, so it's, like, kind of interesting to hear him talk and then kind of go back and watch.
Yeah, you forget. They were a big deal, man.
Big deal, yeah, and it's cool. It's cool that Chris is still making music and still, really involved in the arts, and he's got... Yeah, when he was here, he had just gotten back from, like, Alaska or somewhere crazy. Like, he does a lot of cool traveling. Really interesting guy. But definitely check him out on Twitter, Instagram, at Chris Barron. If you get the chance to see him live, I would. And also check out Commonwealth Press.
Commonwealth Press.
Commonwealth
get
Press.
Get your T-shirts made.
Get your T-shirts made. If you're in a band, you got to do it. don't wait till the last minute. And commonwealthpress.com/podcast, get 6 free shirts. And thanks to them for sponsoring us. Thanks to Chris for coming by. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
For having us.
Thanks, Converse Rubber Tracks.
Thanks, Converse Rubber Tracks, for being so cool to us.
For putting a roof over our heads.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to do this on my own, it would probably sound terrible and no one would be able to find it.
Probably sound like this. Hello.
It would.
We're Skyping in today. Hello, Jonah.
That is actually a sample of my original podcast. But yeah, thanks everyone for listening. If you want to donate, go to goingofftrack.com. Steven was telling me there's some kind of thing, button where you can just donate $1. It's really easy, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know exactly how it works, but check it out. I think if you just click on the donate button, it takes
you
right there.
Pulls it right out of your pocket.
And pulls it literally like a hand comes out of your computer.
Oh, that's right. We have a little drone now.
Yeah.
That flies to people's pockets.
Totally. So check out the Going Off Track drone. Leave us a comment on iTunes if you don't want to give us any money. That's fine, too. Whatever. Tell your friends about it. Tweet about it. Or don't. We're going to keep doing it either way. So...
thank you.
Thank you for listening. Thanks, Chris, for coming by, and we will see you next week.